We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Five Star App Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host, Ariel Garten, one of the founders of brain sensing device Muse. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation, mindfulness, and brain-focused practices have the power to change our lives. Whether you're just learning to meditate or want to deepen your practice, Meditation Studio, with hundreds of guided meditations and over 50 amazing teachers, and Muse, which provides great feedback on your practice, are two awesome tools you'll want to have in your back pocket. Today's guest is Grant Doré. Grant is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Love, Life, Style, and has been called the guardian of all chic, inspiring us to find our own effortless, authentic style. She's also a French photographer, illustrator, storyteller, and Instagram superstar. She's probably best known for her fashion blog at WearDoré.com, where you'll also find her personal diary, filled with her incredibly open stories of self-discovery. She speaks truthfully about her challenge with depression and how it's helped her to be more honest and vulnerable with herself, and how grateful she actually is for the more challenging times in her life because of how they've fueled the changes she's needed to make. It's been a truly interesting healing journey as she travels this path to redefine herself and find a new definition of meaning and purpose while keeping her sense of humor and her edge. This is one of those interviews where you'll really get to know the heart of our guest. You will love her. Now, here's Garance. Garance, it is so exciting to have you on Untangle today. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. I'm so excited about that conversation.
Good. I want to start by giving our listeners a little snapshot into you. And I like to sometimes start by asking you who you were as a child. How would you describe yourself maybe as a 10-year-old?
Well, it's interesting you'd ask that because I'm right now in my studio in LA, and my studio is like become sort of a meditation room and where I do a lot of my creative work. And I have a photo of me that just sitting there that I can look at where I was maybe 11 or 12. And just before becoming a teen, or just right before, And I guess like this photo represents a guide for me, because I think I really loved who I was at that age. And I was probably more than any time in my life who I am today. And so I was very loving, smiley. I loved nature. I grew up in Corsica, so you can't imagine that. I grew up in a place with no cars. There was no road that got there. So there was full freedom for kids. It was the 70s and 80s. So now I compare it to how the kids are raised, and I'm like, oh, it's so different. And I was very connected to the universe. Of course, I didn't call it like that before, but I remember sleeping under the stars a lot. And since it was so remote, well, the skies were amazing. There was no light pollution and all that. And I was also very curious, and also frustration was starting to brew, because growing up on an island is wonderful, but I felt like the world was to explore. So that was me in a snapshot.
Do you feel like some of that inner kind of connection with nature and feeling really maybe even happy and loving changed as you became a teenager? Were you able to hold on to that part of yourself?
I think that deep down it stayed, but I got caught up in all the things that I think we all get caught up. And if we don't have serious guides and mentors, it's hard to keep the direction so easily. So when I was a teenager, I grew very angry. My family situation was tricky. My parents were divorcing, and not in the most peaceful way. I actually don't believe that we should all have perfectly happy childhoods. I just think life is life. My parents were respectful to us, but they were going through something. They were very young. My mom had me when 20. So when you think about how we feel when we're 20 and like having kids, and like, well, by that time they divorced, she was more like around her 30s. So it was kind of like beautiful and messy. There was a lot of love, but there was a lot of like lack of education and relationships. And I started getting angry. It was kind of, you get thrown off the cliff, right? And you're like, okay, good luck, be an adult now. And at the same time, I was a courageous little girl. And so I just went for it. But I think, my teenage years, I think I was very stressed, very angry, and it was difficult.
Did you have any guides or mentors during that time?
Yeah, I was very lonely in terms of having, I had friends and all that, but I didn't have any guidance. And that's been kind of a thread in my life. And it's funny because I was seeing like a psychic the other day, and he was like, that's part of your karma. You have to grow alone, because the lessons you learn are deeper, because you have to learn by trial and error. And that's why you're able to bring them to the world. I think guides come in different shapes and forms, but I also think some people, it's not really my destiny to have that.
Yeah, it's complicated, because it sounds like you are at these different stages of your life. You're definitely asked to get out of your comfort zone. And when you're out of your comfort zone, it's very scary. So I also loved when you said how that certain times in your life, it's beautiful and it's messy, and it requires this resource of courage. And you said you were a very courageous little girl. So I think you have all of the right inner resources, which is really a lovely thing. And then you're offering so much of what you're learning to others. As I read through all of your book and a lot of your blogs, I was coming to see this intersection between a lot of personal exploration that you're doing with style and fashion, which was kind of fun for me to connect all of those. And so I was wondering what inspired you initially to be so interested in style. Was that very natural for you? And then what inspired you to create the blog and start offering out all of that information?
Yeah, first, thank you very much for reading and getting deeply into my world. It's interesting because I've always loved beautiful things. I don't know if you are into astrology, but I'm Taurus. And I think it's a kind of a natural inclination. And also, I come from Corsica, and it's a very Italian culture where people want to look beautiful. I mean, there used to be, it's different now, but you know, this street where everybody would have coffee and or like a drink or a glass of wine, and people would walk by. The way you look was important. And my dad is originally Italian. And so he had that thing. Everybody's elegant. I look at old photos and I mean, people were very elegant in the 40s and all that, but like this very chic. And so kind of naturally, and then my mother, who comes from Morocco, has a, for her, I guess style was a way to affirm herself as a woman. She grew up, it was very difficult because a lot of racism and all that. And I think for her, style and beauty were a way to get out of her condition. My grandmother was a cleaning lady in France, and my mom jumped a lot of ladders in society, if you can call that. She educated herself. But I think her first ticket was style and was beauty and was that kind of thing she cultivated. So she taught us, me and my sister and brothers, very early about that, but just naturally, because she loved surrounding herself with beautiful things, and we had art books and things like that. So this is just the beginning of the answer to your question.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I was always interested in that, always since I was a kid. I was trying to recreate and also remember the frustration. I was in Corsica when I grew up. I was 14 or 15. My dream was to purchase a pair of Converse, but there was no store that would sell that. There was no buy online. And I had to have one of my mom's friends who was going to France. Like, and I was like, please bring me back a pair of Converse. So that was that frustration. Frustration is a great motivation for later. Like the more you accumulate it, it's like an engine that then has a lot of miles to go. And then it was very natural. It is still very natural to me. And I also don't make such a big deal out of it. I'm just having fun. And when I started my blog, this is kind of a long story. And as you can see, I'm not shy with words. But when I started my blog, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to have a style blog. It was just telling stories about my life. But very soon I realized that style was a great way to communicate with people without having to go too deep in the beginning. So I could say a lot about self-acceptance, a quest for the self. And so that's what my book, my first book that you were talking about, is really about. If you read the book, it actually talks about the fact that style comes from deep inside. And that was my whole thesis. And so the clothes just are an expression of who we are.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
So when you started the blog and as you started writing about style, and I did see so much philosophy and voice in your book, Love, Style, and Life, did you define yourself as a seeker then? Or did that come after this, I think you might have called it a self-discovery cycle over the last couple of years, which I do want to talk about. But did this defining yourself as a seeker come then?
It's part of my nature. It's always been that way, which is also why I've never really felt comfortable. And that's why I've moved a lot and changed a lot and all that, because I think this is one thing that defines me, is I'm never really at the same place. Have you seen that TV show Battlestar Galactica, where they're trying to find their true home?
I haven't, but that makes sense.
It's sci-fi. It's like this quest for my home and understanding my home is inside and all that thing. It's always been like that. I started reading Women Who Run With Wolves when I was 20. I was always interested in philosophy. Right now, I'm listening and reading Joseph Campbell, who's talking a lot about the power of myth. I knew always that I was kind of living my own saga and my own. I always felt that way. So I was reading philosophy and I studied literature. So there is a lot of that too. And I needed answers. So books, I went to therapy very early. And also, which is interesting today, I had a time in my 20s where I went to rave parties a lot. And it seems, it's funny because I've always wanted to talk about it because I think it's one of the most interesting times of my life. But I don't think people really understand. But today there are places like Burning Man, so people can understand a little more the culture and what you can learn with these type of things. But I started going to rave parties when I was around 20-something and got really into the music, but also into the idea of community and the idea of redefining an ideal. Because it was not a club culture at all when I jumped on that wagon. It was these new travelers. It was in Europe, so not really in America. It's a European culture. And so all the party was called free parties. And so the same idea that there is no money as at Burning Man and all that. So all these questions for me were very important and how we relate to others and how we can question society and the role we have in it and how we live. So it's just been perpetual quest and I'm still on it. Yeah.
So let me ask you this question, because I read that you felt like before you turned 40, you had this image that being married, having a child, having a dog, living in a house, like there was some ideal. I know that you've reevaluated that vision and I want to talk about that. But did you question that vision?
So that's when you kind of realize that even when you're trying to be smart, you want to be different. And that's something that even it was always hard for me because one of the big things that defined me is like, I'm a rebel, but I'm also very obedient. Yeah, it creates a lot of discomfort. Like, yes. I was always kind of a rebel, but I also wanted to be a good daughter. So it took me into like, so I'm only now learning that I can't keep being a people pleaser or look outside of myself and all that. But it's been like a big, big thing in my life. So I was kind of already an original. I was doing my thing and all that. But the depths to which these standards are like imprinted in ourselves, we don't really know. So we're all living on that thing, or like I was living on that thing where I was like, oh, I'm having fun. But at some point, or like, you know, I'm living my life, I'm living an artistic life and I'm living a life kind of outside of an original dreamy. But at some point, something's going to happen and I'm going to have a child, have a husband, have a house type of thing. I think some part of me didn't even believe in my freedom. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because there are so many cultural influences. And I think when you're a seeker, you're always questioning what you're feeling internally with what is happening externally and with your community and your friends and out in the world and in media. I think it can be very confusing, and especially when you're such a rebel and beautiful seeker. And do you feel like there was something that shifted you into saying, I want to own this rebel part of myself? I want to create my own life based on what I believe is right.
You know how we talk about peeling the onion?
Yes.
I just think it's a thick layer, but it's just a layer, because I actually had these moments that, how do you call, epiphanies or something, these moments where you suddenly have to change your point of view. I had them a few times in my life. I remember one very big one was when I, right before I started doing the blog, and I was like, okay, I can either become a teacher or I can become an illustrator. And on the one side of teacher, I was like, okay, so I'll know how much I make, I have the job security, but I will also know exactly what my life is going to be for the next 50 years. And then on the other side, there was being an illustrator, and maybe I'm going to not even make it a day, but at least, you know, I'll be curious. You come to crossroads at many times in your life, and I think each time you refine who you are. So what I mean to say is, like, I want to keep on being a writer and all that, but I'll never say that I found the exact solution and that I had my come to Jesus and that's it. I think there will be many different other layers that will bring me closer to contentment and happiness. But that moment that you're referring to, maybe the most important moment in terms of pain, I think that's when I actually felt true pain. The story was that I was getting in my early 40s and I was trying to have a baby and it wasn't working. And I think I went through interior hell. I didn't wanna, like, keep doing, and that's a personal choice, but I did one IVF and I talked about it. And then I was like, my body can't take that level of hormones. I'm not strong enough for that. So after that choice came a lot of doubt and questioning what I wanted, what I was doing. Meanwhile, mourning.
Right.
It's almost too difficult to explain. And it was obviously caused by not being able to have a baby. I think depression, when that bell rang and when I started, it was just one day and I had suicidal thoughts and I was like, okay, you got to take care of yourself now. That's the moment where I was like, I don't give a shit about anything else, my work, having a baby or not, like anything. And yeah. So that was my wake up call. But if I look back, it's not one event. It had been building for years. So it's always, to me, like there is so much subtlety in life that it's kind of difficult. There is a lot of subtlety and
yes.
There is not just one event, then we are on the floor. You know, it's that image, it's like in Eat, Pray, Love, oh, you're on the bathroom floor, like, oh, my life needs to change and you go away. It's much more in like layers and subtlety and years. And so that's my long answer to your question.
Yeah, no, I love that you're sharing all of that. And I think that a wake-up call can be such a blessing. And in some of your blogs, I remember you said the process of becoming a mature adult is both cruel and fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then you talked about depression as everything you'd been carrying around for years. It just suddenly becomes too heavy. Suddenly you feel something's not right. That is actually a really good thing sometimes, but it's very scary too. And then you talk also about little by little, you started to get your joy back and that you weren't feeling strangled by your narrative. And I love when you say you lost your attachment to your own suffering. You did a lot of different things in your own healing process. I think it's so interesting that you talk about not being strangled by your narrative. A lot of people don't maybe understand that, but we all do it. And so I'm just curious what your process was coming out of that wake up call, let's call it. And what was your process to find that part of yourself again?
I was sitting in my living room and I was having my coffee and I didn't even know what I was feeling at this point. I just knew I was waking up every morning and it was dark and in my mind. And suddenly, like, the thought of suicide and death came to me, but it was weird because it was just like almost like that would be comfortable, that would be good. And I realized that, you know, it's like monsters, they never come announced, they come in like sheep's clothes, right? And you're like, and it was the same week that Anthony Bourdain committed suicide, and there was also Kate Spade, and I got really scared. The first thing I did was going to a psychiatrist. And I want to say that because mental health is a very important thing to me today, obviously, but it's always been. And I think it's important to first take it seriously. I want to talk about that because before I took these like very simple steps, I, feeling so bad, had started seeing a lot of healers. And I think that when we're not feeling well, these things can be pretty dangerous. So you have to have a base of feeling good to go work on your soul with people, to see psychics and all that. But to me, it took me down an even more tricky road, which is the one of magic thinking.
Yes.
Which I have never really talked about that before, but because I'm only coming out of that, but the road to suicidal thoughts was a lot of magical thinking that was often encouraged, right?
Yeah.
You know, we all go through that when you have a problem such as not being able to have a child, you resort to a lot of things, right? Because everybody has a solution and they're like, oh, go see my masseuse and go see my healer. And that person wants to see my healer and they got pregnant 3 weeks later and this and that. And you're like, well, I'll try everything, right? I mean, I know that for me, it was probably one of the things that made me lose balance. And I think that's in this world of wellness in which we are today, I think it's important to remember that, which is also why I'm a true believer in meditation, because meditation is about just the now. It's not about angels. As much as like I'm very open to all this, I think you have to be so strong inside first. So that's the first thing I did. I went to see a psychiatrist and I chose someone that also had kind of a mind-body approach, obviously. So I think it's important to like choose your team. I knew I was not doing well and I knew that I didn't have help, meaning I didn't have a mentor, I didn't have a guide, I didn't have friends that could help me at that time. So I told myself, and that's when see the strong part of me comes out. And I was like, I need a team around me. So I went and got a psychiatrist and got a psychologist, called my business partner. I was like, I think I need to stop. And she told me, you need to stop working for a while, because I explained to her how I was feeling. So that's when I pulled all my, the safety blankets, I guess, like where it's like, okay, first that when that moment happened, went to the psychiatrist, I started taking antidepressants, which is a thing that I never thought I would have to resort to. And that was the beginning of my healing. And at the same moment, I was like, for a moment, until I feel better, no more spiritual, I'm not ready for that. So I let all that on the side, all the healers, anybody that could come and get in my mind, whether it's with their words or with their influence and all that, I was like, I need to do some important cleaning in there. And some important like weeding out and all that. And I need also to understand that all these people that I'm seeing, whether it's a doctor, because sometimes it can be also pretty difficult hearing things that they tell you, or a healer that has no certifications and is just a friend of a friend of a friend that started, I don't know.
Right.
You have to be really careful. So yeah, that's how I started. And then building my tools, I had to build on a very sane and simple. My psychiatrist, when I went to see him, was like, oh, we have to build you a new emotional and psychological house. And that I wanted that house to be built on very sturdy and strong foundations. And so my tools, the first one that he helped me discover, that I had a very important sleeping problem, which I didn't know. I just thought I was just like very energetic, waking up early, doing stuff and thinking about things all the time and all that. But I was actually an insomniac, waking up at 4 a.m, just like, start early and the world belongs to you kind of thing. So it's always been like that, but it was also hiding a pretty important sleeping problem. So that's what I spent my last summer doing, is sleep. Literally, like I was like, I stopped working and I started sleeping.
How did you figure out how to sleep better? Were you taking medication for sleep or did you just change all your cycles?
Well, that's such a good question. I didn't take medication, but I tried a lot of things. I tried CBD, all the things, you know, magnesium, like trying to stay natural. Obviously, I've never been I don't pop pills. I just don't. So that's why also for me, like I was it's a very low level of antidepressants, but it was still like a big, big deal for me. And now I found what helps my sleep. Like ashwagandha is a big thing for me. It really works. I think you have to test and try. Like CBD doesn't do that much. So substances, of course, some of them really work, but I also don't want to overuse them because I don't want to get used to them and need them. Yeah. But the most important thing for sleeping is sleeping. Basically, when you don't sleep, you start putting yourself into high cortisol, high stress, high like kind of fight or flight, and you lose even more sleep. And because you're so tired, your body is so tense to keep you going. Usually you also medicate with chocolate, sugar, coffee, like alcohol, all these things. And they actually lower your quality of sleep depending on when and how much you eat. So it's like our bodies are subtle. We're subtle human beings. So I started by just sleeping, just getting in touch with myself and also finding the signs. What does it mean when I sleep well? How do I feel? Because I had forgotten. I didn't know. It had been decades that I haven't had a good night of sleep. So for me, waking up already running and my brain rushing was my normal. And I realized as I was starting to really heal myself that when I sleep well, I wake up and I don't even know where I am. It takes me 15 minutes to like get out of the cloud, and that's beautiful. So that was my first thing. Sleeping is the foundational for health, and health is mental health. And then everything goes together, right? We're like these very, very subtle machines in a way that you have to turn the little buttons. Like, So diet is very important. And I want to say as we speak that I am not at any perfect place at the moment. I was just writing about that. You just tend, you try to, you keep going. And that's our life's work. There is not a moment where I'm like, I'm not the person who's going to tell you, oh yeah, I don't eat this, I don't eat that. But I'm always trying to feel better and see how, like last night I didn't sleep so well. Yesterday I ate a lot of sugar.
So there's you can start seeing the connections
Exactly. You start seeing the connections, you explore, which is why my main things with the retreats we organize is self-discovery, because that's the heart of everything. So then there is sleep and there is nutrition and all these like base, like very, very simple things that I think before I would advise anybody to do a retreat or like start meditation or all these things, I would be like, what about a good night of sleep? A good like healthy soup before you go to bed and see how you feel in the morning. And if like maybe half of your problems are not there anymore, keep doing that and take time for yourself. And so, yeah, that's been my healing journey. And then bringing some tools that are anchors. So meditation is one of them, which is the same. I'm not this like perfect meditator. There is days where I don't. But the interesting thing is that I the same as sleep. When I don't do it, I don't feel as well. So right. It's like you come back to it and you sway away. And journaling is a big one for me, but I almost never talk about it because it's breathing for me. I've always done that. I'm a writer. I don't even think about it. I tell my stories like on my journal every day, but very important to me. And therapy, talking. My dog has been like a lifeline for me because I never had dogs before. I mean, when I was a kid, but then later in my life, I was traveling so much. And when my relationship ended, because I don't know for your listeners, we couldn't have a baby. It's not just one person. But then we also broke up. So it was kind of the end of that dream, right? The dream mm-hmm. of like the perfect everything. And that's when I found myself single. And I was writing about that. All my fears had crystallized. I was that single woman, childless in her 40s. And that was kind of what I had been fearing. Like a lot of women fear that. And that's when I also realized, oh, this is actually pretty great. It was a giant shift, but I had to experience it for myself. And like, don't we say like, you kind of run to your fears, like you make them happen. So it's better to identify them very early, I guess. So my dog was there. I was me and my dog and I kept the house. So it was in this big house. And I was like, what the hell did I do with my life? But she was carrying such grace and peace. And she was giving me so much affection.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like even to this day, it's a pretty sacred relationship we have with our pets.
I feel exactly the same way. Our relationships with our dogs are so sacred. So it's such a big shift, let go of this dream of a perfect ending, only to find that life can be even better and might even feel more real without hanging on to that perfect ending. And so I wanted to ask you this question. Your journey has really brought you to this deeper knowing of yourself. How are you feeling now that you've been through so much and you just finished your first silent retreat? Tell me how you're feeling and then let's get into some of the juiciness and challenges of your retreat experience.
I think that how I'm feeling today is more in a state of openness and maybe like less judgmental about who I am and others and where I should be. So there is much less shoulds. I feel a tremendous freedom. I always consider, you know, how we get all these ideas and we always kind of put them back and be like, oh no, you're crazy. But I open them. Like I had, like, for example, I want to learn Spanish and I was like, well, maybe I should go live for 2 months in Mexico. And just that's this kind of thing where before, right away, I would be like, yeah, whatever, you know, I can't or something. And now I'm like, no, how can I make this work? So could I rent my house for 2 months and then take my stuff and go work there? And what kind of project should I do? And it's the same with everything. But like any impulse that I have, instead of treating it like a crazy thought, I'm like, no, how can I manage? What can I do? Is it real? Like, what is it going to bring me and all that? So I feel like that's how I want to live my life now. And that's what I do.
I love
Hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are four experts in psychology that bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
Love that, because I've been thinking a lot lately about how we judge ourselves and how can we move from this state of judging ourselves mm-hmm. and others into a state of curiosity. And that's exactly what you're doing. You're starting to ask yourself, like, why did I have that thought? How could I make that happen? Do I really want to do it?
Yeah, well, I think that's what meditation teaches you is mm-hmm. before judging, observing, not taking things personally, being like, that person triggers me. But instead of like going into it, being like, okay, so why is a person that triggers me in my entourage? Why is there that person around me? Why do I get triggered? Instead of being like, oh, that person is toxic, like, you know, this new word, like, well, then why did I choose that person to be around me? What can I do? How can I? So it's like, it's that breath. It's that second before we get engaged into mm-hmm. judgment, into conclusions, into shoulds, into it's impossible. And it gives incredible power. And when I'm talking about power, I am talking about the good power. I feel like often it's, mm-hmm. it's a word that's kind of loaded because it's been used as like this big, I'm better than everyone power. Whereas I think being powerful is that quiet confidence. That's what I want to develop. It's also that sense of being oneself and following our gut. So to me, that's true power.
You're really tapping into something that's so critical, which is, you know, our meditation practice isn't just about meditating on the cushion or in a chair. It's about taking all of these tools that we learn from practicing in daily life, which is the hardest thing to do.
I just came back from that silent retreat. I haven't meditated in like 3 days. I'm actually like a pretty normal meditator. I'm not this every day at 6:30 a.m. I'm on my cushion. No, I have very like off and on, like I have to go back to it. So it's a relationship with something. It's like, I love you. Oh, now I'm bored. I don't want to do it. Oh, this is the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm going to sit for an hour. Oh, I can only do 2 minutes today because it's driving me crazy. But that's the thing, when you start getting into that, it's everything is practice, mm-hmm. everything. Not meditating and wondering why and having a crappy day is practice, like all these things. And it's always been, well, being a writer, it's always been that way for me, where life is an adventure. And for me, it's stories to tell. So I've always been an observator. That's always been kind of my thing. But now I have even more this depth and I can apply it to myself.
So this was your first silent retreat.
Yes.
How many days was it?
It was a metta loving kindness retreat mm-hmm. that was silent, and it was a 6-day retreat.
And so was that the longest that you'd ever been in silence?
Yeah, it's actually the very first time. I do shut up sometimes because I like to spend some days alone, but I'm always either writing or reading. And I don't know if your listeners know, but on a silent retreat, it's not just the act of not talking. It's basically not communicating, not looking at people in the eyes, not journaling, not reading. So it's basically like get inside and just deal with your brain. So it was my very first time and it was a challenge for me. I had it was Game of Thrones with my ego, because one of the things that people don't talk often about and that really struck me was that you get there and there is this beautiful place, just also kind of with a sort of monastic type of vibe, because you take care of your own room. It's not a hotel, right? You're not going. So you have tasks you have to do. I was cleaning the kitchen, like things like that. So there is this part, and you get there and, you know, you're going to wear mostly sweatpants because you're going to be meditating about 10 hours a day at least. And so you want to be really comfortable, and you can't do your thing. So you can't talk and all that. And it was very interesting for me was to lose that part, because That's who I am. I'm this fun, charming person, right? And get in a room, and that's my mechanism. That's how I did my life. It's by, you know, engaging with people, telling stories, making them laugh. And then when I'm not that, I felt like I was nothing. So that was, to me, the first challenge. And I'm not saying that I resolved anything. I'm just saying I was finally able to see the constructs of the self that I created. And then the resistance came to me in terms of like my sense of irony, because being an observer often comes with also irony, a sense of whether it's judgment or sense of humor or things like that. So I couldn't refrain myself from looking at people, asking myself what the hell I was doing here. So a lot of like different resistance like that. And I remember also having these obsessive thoughts. So that's the daily thing that I experienced, solo little bubble, which made me almost forget that I was also at the same time living this tremendous experience. So meditating was hard because I never meditate for so long. And then you have to do these walking meditations and everybody looks like a zombie. Yeah. Oh my God, fear of the walking dead. What's going on? You know?
Yes.
It's crazy. And so I would use that time because you're free. Like nobody's after you, like forcing you to do the meditation walk. So I would go get myself a tea or take a nap. And I was like, oh, you're slacking it. Go try to do it. And then you have this conversation with the teacher twice during the retreat. I was like, what can I do? I can't do the zombie walk. And he was like, do some yoga, stay focused. The idea is to like stay in your meditative state and in your mindful state and all that. So I tried to find, so there was a lot of struggles for me, which made me forget. And then I remembered after how profound it is to be meditating with 100 people and calling in self-love. Love for the people you love for the people you hate, love for the world, basically kind of raising the vibration together. And I now, looking back, I wouldn't change that experience, though I regret not being able to connect with the higher purpose and staying basically a week connected to my lower needs. But it's also a lesson. And I'm glad that the quality of the teaching was insane. I didn't grow up in a religious background, so I never went to church or anything. This retreat was really a Buddhist environment, which is beautiful. Every evening there is a Dharma talk. Mm-hmm. To be able to sit and talk about love and life in such broad, deep, meaningful terms and ask ourselves the real questions. Oh my God. So that's something that I definitely want to cultivate. Because again, it's that idea of giving the depth that life is not just on one plan. Like, you know, of course we need to work and grow our lives and our families and buy houses and be successful or whatever. But what are we doing here? How can we contribute? So that was beautiful. And insights are still coming every day.
When I am in silent retreat and then come home, I always want to take a part of it with me. And then you want to stay in that deep feeling, deep compassion, connection. But little by little, as you get back into your daily life, some of it gets chipped away. And I'm always trying to think of ways to bring some of that feeling home.
It's interesting because I've been doing retreats. I've been doing fasting retreats. I've been doing hiking retreats, which is each of them are profound. I think we can all practice these things on our own or with a group of friends. I'm dreaming to do that, say, to three of my friends, let's go hike for 3 days and be silent and just be together. I really have two very opposite sides of myself. I really have fun and I'm meeting a lot of people and all that. But in general, during the year, I try to take a day a week to just stop everything. It's definitely a luxury because I can do it because I don't have children, just have a dog and all that. But I shut off my phone. I don't see anyone, no plans at all. So the day can be whatever I want it to be. I can stay in bed or I can go to the beach or I can read a book or whatever. But the idea is to have as little pressure to do anything as possible and try to eat very mindfully. And often I try to give myself 2 or 3 hours of full mindfulness, so full conscious. So basically like what you do when you're in meditation, which is like if you eat something, really taste the taste. If you look at something, really look at the light and how it hits it. And it doesn't need to be like going somewhere and paying some money and doing a retreat. It can be something that we cultivate in our everyday life.
Well, that goes back to what you were saying before about feeling like you are in more of a state of openness and there's freedom. It's so liberating.
It's interesting because like meditation is meditation and you need to sit. And, you know, I know some people say, oh, my meditation is my running or I get it. But yeah. I talked a lot with my meditation teacher and I agree that meditation is meditation. You sit and you're in a specific position so you don't fall asleep. All these things, but mindfulness, you could be like, okay, you know, I'm going to do my laundry. I'm going to do it in full conscience. So I'm going to like do everything, take a little step and take a breath. And there is, and time becomes really slow and you hold yourself straighter because you're in the moment. You could feel it. Your body is so much more alert.
Right.
You know, as soon as you start getting in that state. So I do that and I actually love it. And I started doing it and it was this magical thing. I was cleaning my studio upstairs and I was like, instead of doing it while listening to a podcast and not thinking or talking, I'm going to do it with my full attention. Well, first, it's really funny because when you're in this state, you feel very Japanese, right? You're like, everything to be in the right place. And I'm a pretty messy person by nature. Like my mom was always going crazy because my room was an explosion and all that. But the more I do these types of exercises, the more I need like clean space, everything is wet in its own place.
It's such a great exercise to do that. I remember I came back from a retreat in May and we were given the task to just do one thing every day for 30 days, really slowly, mindfully with awareness. And I just chose making my bed in that way because I do everything so fast, you know.
I'm the same. We are, most of us are the same.
We are. We just want to do it fast. And it was really helpful to do it slow for a while, but I think I have gotten back into the fast habit. But it's a general, like it's an awareness. And when you do something fast, know that you're doing it fast. You know, I think that's a big part of what our mindfulness shows us is that we're not perfect, but we have more awareness.
Yes. And also, this is not another place to be judgmental.
Exactly.
This is not another thing where, oh no, I didn't do my job of being mindful while in my bed. That's also the teachings, you know, of meditation and mindfulness. It's like, no, like anytime you hate on yourself because you didn't do, it's just, like, this is not the direction.
No. So, and it's having compassion for yourself too.
My whole theory about life is that if people love themselves more, we would love the planet more. You know, it starts with ourselves. So the respect that we give ourselves starts like vibrating all around us. We can't hurt because we wouldn't do it to ourselves. And it becomes this new way of seeing and this new way of relating to ourselves. And everyone, I'm struggling with self-appreciation, self-respect, self-love. I'm nowhere near where I was years ago. That's also why I left the world of fashion, because I think it's a cultivation of a lot of self-judgment. And I needed to get out of there if I wanted to heal. And I'm learning. And I can say that I'm starting to feel really comfortable, really at home with my body and my soul. And I wouldn't want to be anyone else. There is a sense of peace, inner peace that's growing inside. And that's priceless because that's, and you know, this sense of being my own best friend, which seems kind of stupid to say, but it's that idea that I love spending time with myself. I love my thoughts. And that was funny actually on the silent retreat. The first 2 days, I was like, so you can't entertain yourself, right? There's nothing to entertain yourself. So I was just sitting there when I had free time and I would literally be like, oh, let me think for a second. That was my entertainment. So I was daydreaming and I realized I like thinking. Thinking can be, but now I can see it as entertainment. Sitting there, I was sitting on my bed and like making plans and scenarios and thinking about a boy and like all these things. I realized it was almost like watching TV. So all that to say, I'm at home with myself and I like that. And I like looking at my thoughts and directing them and all that. I feel like all this practice and this work on the self that I am doing is really, truly worth it.
In one of your blogs, and I think this is even from last year, as you were going through this journey of self-discovery, you talked about rediscovering joy and the passion for things that you love. And I feel like this is the silent retreat, and where you are today has all been sort of an opening and redefining of joy for you. Do you have a different way that you think about success now in terms of your business and your writing and the work that you do? Has that shifted for you?
I think it's always going to be a big thing for me, because I'm trying to think as I'm speaking, but definitely this question of what is success has been a big question for me. And not just for me, but also because I have the media and all that. And
I'm
very, very conscious about the people I present as being successful, because everything is narrative, everything. I've been, in the recent years, we've been presenting this, like, what have been called like badass women. I've been very, very mindful of not relaying that kind of narrative, for example, because to me, I see people behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And having a Fortune 500 company and 7 kids, and also like going to the gym every day. And also, if that rocks your boat, that's great. I just really don't think that's the only way. I mean, to me, it's a little bit insane. There is too much there, and I'm not going to go into that. But I just feel like presenting this as like the ultimate success, mm-hmm, is such a wrong thing to do. And it's so much pressure to put on people. And also, it's not considering what if you're happy.
Right.
Success to me is like being happy, feeling peaceful, feeling like I'm at this age that you're already thinking, is life just piling up shit? Like houses and friends and piling up successes and one thing after the next. Is it that? And at the same time, finding the freshness of desire. And that's maybe like, if you're asking me, what is your main struggle in terms of mindfulness, is like, can I keep a little bit of my ego, because I kind of like the edge that it gives me? I like the grit. The first part of my career was basically proving to my mother that I could do it.
Yes.
If you want to like sum it up, it's like she thought I couldn't do it and I did it. And well, yeah, that was definitely like some psychological thing, but it was also amazing to have this like fire under my ass and all that. And I'm not saying like when you're fully mindful and you're let go of all your trauma and all that, you can't do great things. But I'm recognizing that maybe I'm not ready, maybe in 10 years, because I was talking to one of the teachers at the Silent Retreat. I was like, so I'm in a transitional time in my career, but like if I follow what we're saying, I basically want to just sit there and love the world and do nothing. I was like,
oh, right? No.
And I was like, can I keep a little bit of my ego and my grit so that I can go after something next? And how do you do it? And the answer is, and I found it very unsatisfactory, which I thought, well, it probably means that you're not ready and it's okay. Go back and prove shit to the world if you need. But the answer was, well, after you've gone through that, you want to start doing things for the good of the world. And I agree, but I'm still struggling with the idea. And I think that's very healthy.
But Laurence, you know, we're not monks who live on mountains.
Exactly.
In an uncomplicated, yeah, world. Mm-hmm. Our lives are very messy and we do want things sometimes. Mm-hmm. And when I first started, and I think I deal with this a little bit now too, I had that same question about how do you keep your edge? The kinder and gentler we become. And I've been meditating for 20 years. I still have an edge. I still get triggered. We live in this world. We're doing the best that we can.
Yes.
And you, especially, you're so passionate about the work that you do. And you have such a unbelievably beautiful way of being able to express ideas, which is such a gift. I think we find what that balance is that makes sense for ourselves. But unless you go live on a mountain, unless we give up who we are as human beings, I don't think we can lose our edge.
It's interesting because we're talking about like some me coming out of basically like probably like 2 or 3 years where I was maybe in a more depressive state or like more contracting state as opposed to expansion state. So like for in my 30s, I was in my real expansion state and I did all the things that we talked about, you know, like have a successful business and all that. And I believe that today life is really longer. And so we're going to go through different embodiments of ourselves and all that. And so when that energy kind of died down for me, I lost my edge and I lost my desire and I lost my passion and I just wanted to stay home and basically just do nothing. I didn't want to travel anymore. And these times are also very pregnant with things. And that's also something that we don't acknowledge enough, this breath. You know, we're in a time where we are pushed to be productive all the time. And I come from France where summer vacations are really long to where you get bored, which is the healthiest thing because we're still children in a way and children need to be bored and that's where they get their creativity and all that. So like going back to that state once a year, I mean, it should be more often, but at least we have that. I think America is so much about productivity that we forget that we need these moments and then we can find a different edge. Like, where does the source of my desire come from now? Like, it used to come from that incredible desire to prove something. Not that I've proven something, but even more if you're expecting yourself to come up with new projects and new ideas and new desires, you need to let things die and let things disappear. Even more because today our careers are so long and things change and economies change and everything like moves around us and we have to be able to be adaptable. But in order to be that, we need to be able to take off and just like take a break and figure out ways to do that, which sometimes means for some people reorganizing, selling the house and living in a studio for a year so we don't have to spend that much money and we can figure ourselves out. And so that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about that freedom that kind of exploded in me, or I'm like, don't stay too attached to things and stuff and all that, because you need to keep that freedom.
That probably fuels your inspiration and creativity so much, because you can't keep that turned on all the time. And it also seems like sometimes our bodies force us into the cave when our mind doesn't know we're ready.
Of course.
Your body knows when you're exhausted or when you're about to shut down before your mind knows. So you learn to pay more attention to that.
Yeah, it's the same thing as, you know, when you're exhausted and you have to keep going and you drink coffee and you keep on nerves. You know that you're not in your positive energy. You're in your very nervous. When I was looking at this coming from fashion, these designers that were pressed so much in like creating all these collections. And then the source has to become the ego at some point. And that's what people feed. And so you started from a true place of creativity and soulfulness and all that. And then because you're so pressed and exhausted, the only thing that can keep you going is like feeding that ego. And then you have problems.
You get into that cycle.
Yeah, exactly. And then either your body says stop. So I think it's really important to know that we're not machines.
That is so well put. I love talking to you, Grants. I could talk to you forever. Let me ask you, I think, a final question, unless another one pops into my head. Do you have a favorite book that you keep on your bedside?
I think one of my favorite books is definitely Women Who Run With Wolves. I mean, there is nothing that comes close in terms of the symbolism. You know, it's a little bit like The Hero's Journey, Joseph Campbell, explaining that we're our own heroes and explaining how this works and also the universality and the fact that the problem we have today or the problems we have today are the problems we had centuries ago. The human experience is just like such a repeated thing and it's so interesting. And I think this book is talking to me in images. I reread it often and this book really keeps on giving. I started reading it when I was 20 and it talks about the divine feminine and all these things that as women we still really have so much work to do to be proud of and recapture. I think our femininity has been so stifled over all these years, and relearning how to be a wild woman is one of the most powerful thing we can do, because then we can be more generous with everything, all the complexity and the intelligence and the intuition that we have. When we cut it to ourselves, we don't have it to give to others. So this is a very important book for me and very foundational for me.
Do you have any favorite inspirational quotes?
I think it's Mae West, and she was like, "I've learned so much from my mistakes. I'm thinking of making a few others."
Oh, I love that.
And it really defines what I think about life. It's like, yeah, you start looking at your mistakes, not as mistakes, but as this fabulous adventure where you did your best and you fucked up and it's wonderful and it's stories to tell.
Yeah.
Like, what's better? You know what happened at the silent retreat that was hilarious? Is that I, being unable to completely drop my ego, it's a week, right? I started kind of looking at people and they're kind of hidden. And obviously after a few days, I start zooming in on a guy that's kind of hot.
I go on that
silent retreat, like, all like, trying to meditate and all that. But meanwhile, like, I start like dressing cuter and all that.
Oh,
and
that's funny.
I can see like at some point that he's also looking at me. I'm like, I cannot believe I'm going to meet a guy at a silent retreat. And I was there with a friend, and when we broke silence, I was like, "Hey, can you go give that guy my phone number?"
I've heard this happening before. This is hilarious.
Of course, we're human. We're not, you know, we're human, and it was so interesting. And actually, like, as she was walking towards him, he walked towards me and asked me for my phone number, and I was like, wow. "It's really funny because it's just like, I probably will never see him again. That's not the story of like, oh, I met the love of my life." But I just want to say, like, take it easy. Take everything easy and have fun. And if you see a guy at your silent retreat, have fun with it.
That is so perfect. I'm glad you told us that story. Yay, we're human. Oh, you'll have to let us know what happens.
I will.
Okay, good. Oh, thank you so much, Garance. It's such a pleasure and an honor to talk to you. And I just love your wisdom journey. So thank you, thank you, thank you for being with us.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Garance for being with us today. You'll find her website at wearedore.com. Her book, Love, Life, Style, can be found at all major booksellers. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at founders@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio in the App Store and check out Muse at choosemuse.com. We'll see you next time.